You're listening to the Isoka Podcast. I'm your host, Safia Kazi, and in this podcast episode, I'm excited to be joined by Frank Downs and Dustin Brewer. Frank is Isoka's Senior Director of Cybersecurity Advisory and Assessment Solutions, and Dustin is Principal Futurist at Isoka. In this episode, we're talking a little bit about the first hack that ever happened and some lessons we can learn from it. So to begin, Frank, can you just get us started by telling us a little bit about what the first hack was?
So depending on who you ask and where you look, a lot of people have come to the consensus that the first ever, like, quote, hack happened back in 1903. Now, this is up for debate, right? I like to liken it to many other fields. For example, when I was in grad school, I tried to identify the first example of an NBC attack, right? Nuclear, biological, or chemical attack. And if you really wanted to be a stickler about things, you could talk about how the ancient Greeks put a bunch of snakes, right, in pots when they were fighting on the Mediterranean and would throw them at other boats. Well, the first time, you know, two people put string between two cans and started talking, the person with scissors hacked that by disrupting their call. No, we're not going to do anything like that. But
well, I would argue, though, that also you could say that, like, the Trojan horse, which is an actual attack nowadays, like, I'd say that's a hack,
there we
too,
go.
Right?
And it was that's a good one because it was a form of communication.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They thought it was from the gods. Right.
If you talk to a lot of different professionals and the prevalent sentiment online, right, as well as several other academic papers, if we want to make sure that we've got real bona fides there, although I could argue that certain people online have a bit more bona fides than some of the academics in the field, 1903 would be the year that most people point to. Now, what happened in 1903? Well, if you think about that kind of 30 to 40 year eras, what was it, Dustin, where the first telegraph happened? I want to say that was in the 1860s, right?
Somewhere around that time, yeah. And then there was, of course, Marconi's transatlantic signaling that he did with over the Atlantic. So that was a big step for wireless communications.
So yeah. When Marconi did that transatlantic kind of signaling, the wired industry got kind of concerned, right? Because just like today, it takes a lot of money to put a cable between point A in Europe or Asia and point B in North America, right? You've got these huge oceans to go across. And if all of a sudden things can be done wirelessly, well, there goes your investment. So what did the actual telegraph industry do? Well, as Marconi was about to present part of his findings for what he claimed to be a very private and secure wireless communication method, they had a, and I'm not kidding, professional magician named Maskelyne, specifically Neville Maskelyne, come and take a look at the different elements of, you know, how this was being performed, how wireless communication was happening. Now, it sounds weird that they hired a magician, but if you actually look into the time, it actually makes a lot of sense, because one of the first people that started to use this were magicians. Because think about it. If you're sending wireless communications from point A to point B, you can do a lot of things that seem, quote, magic. Maskelyne would use wireless communications, for example, by planting people in his audience to communicate with things with secreted little telegraph boxes and so forth so that they could communicate back and forth. And it would seem like he's reading minds, etc. Now, of note, if you want to fast forward to today, certain televangelists have been caught with this as well, only on a different level, with little ear communications coming from, like, the top box during their big services. Now, going back to Maskelyne, right? What was interesting was he kind of had an idea that this was all a farce, right? That this was not going to be some kind of private communication. But the telegraph industry, they didn't have at the time the professionals to really assess what was going on here. So they hired this magician to take a look, and they started funding his operations to try and figure out what was going on. And one of the things that Maskelyne did was, among other things, he built these huge antennas. One was you can go visit one of them. I think it's still up 50 meters. Yeah, 50 meters tall. And he was able to intercept all of the communications that Marconi was putting out. In fact, he went on to further say the hardest part was dealing with the incredibly high power output that Marconi was using and working through that. So as he started to figure it out, he started to realize that, hey, anybody can kind of listen to this. Just because you're attuned to a very specific part of the frequency, right? Just because you have a very small part of the frequency that you're communicating on doesn't mean that it's secret. It just means that it's a smaller part of the frequency. So if someone else is tuned to it, they can totally hear what's going on and communicate back and forth. So as Macrony's partner in crime, well, not crime, in business, however you want to put it, invention at this point, right, was setting up at the actual Royal Academy of Sciences, right before Macrony was scheduled to send his specific communication to his partner, all of a sudden, in front of everybody at the academy, the telegraph starts going off. And they started to wonder what's going on. And I think it was Flemings, if I remember correctly, was the partner. He noticed that the word rats over and over and over again was being sent directly to him. Now, they had communicated beforehand, and the partner knew that Macrony was not going to be sending the word rats. But just to make sure it was especially clear, all of a sudden, a rather vulgar poem was sent as well. And everybody at the Royal Academy is here witnessing this. So, after a few days, Mesklin comes forward and says, "That was me. I take credit. Just to show you that it's not secure." Now, in this day and age, right, if somebody did that, they stand a good shot of going to jail. But instead, what happens in 1903? Well, big articles written back and forth in the papers calling each other, you know, heartless and a scallywag and so forth, right? I imagine.
Right. It was all very... It was all very civilized back then.
Very civilized, hurtfully placed words.
That's right.
And you know, it's interesting because you take a look at that and it actually echoes. You can see the core there is still here today. And Dustin and I were talking about this. What's really interesting about it is that the only thing that's really changed in this instance, you had one company trying to protect its interests, right? Funding someone to attack. Everyone, though, if you take a look at how attacks have evolved over time, you still have, you know, interest versus interest and so forth and compromising, quote, secure communications, but on a much grander yet intimate scale. Right now, everybody is a Macrony and there are so many different attackers that are out there and exist. And they're not all magicians, by the way. I bet there's a few magicians, though. I bet there's a few definitely. Magician oh, hackers, yeah. And I hope they have a business card that says magician hacker that actually, you know, are consistently thinking of new ways to subvert the communication for whatever ends. Right. We've seen as since 1903, it's not just business anymore. Then it became more prevalent in governments. And in fact, it is still prevalent in governments. And then, man, what you saw the huge big rash in the 90s and the aughts. Right. Where there was just wave after wave of cybercrime. I remember General Alexander, who was the director of NSA at the time, said, unbeknownst to the majority of the world, and it wasn't a secret, right? We have undergone in the last, I think it was 10 to 15 years, the biggest transfer of wealth in human history just in cyber attacks against banks, mm-hmm. right? So you see that different actors are at play. And as we've continued to progress, now everyone's a target. Not everyone had access to a telegraph, right? So a lot of people were secure just simply because they didn't have the technology. But now, in fact, the majority of people are at risk. You are at risk even if you don't have a phone anymore, right? Because they're able to use phones to identify people who don't have phones. So it's interesting to see how one little thing – okay, we could argue it's not so little at the time. But one kind of hijink prank to prove that someone isn't actually secure in their new invention and communication has kind of grown and morphed into something that we have to think of daily, right? Or people should think of daily. And we thought it was really interesting because just like a lot of other trends, right, the evolution and so forth has picked up and kind of snowballed and snowballed and snowballed. Yet at this core of the snowball, you still have this event. You still have these seeds that are applicable throughout everything else.
And, you know, going back to the original hack here, like I do think it's – and if you think about it, Marconi and Fleming were both basically saying, look, you know, we have this new technology. We have patents on this new technology. We're really the only ones who know how it works. And, you know, we kind of take for granted radio signals nowadays because, they're everywhere. We all have them in our house. We have Wi-Fi going. We have everything else going. We have XM radio. We still have FM and AM radio still going. And, you know, everything's solid state now. But back in the day, back when these technologies were first coming out, it was kind of an ordeal to just tune to the right frequency. It was difficult. It wasn't so difficult that, you know, not anybody, you know, that anybody with the technology or with the pieces of equipment couldn't do it. But it was, you know, to an extent, they were basically trying to say, like, hey, this is a secure form of communication. One of my favorite quotes from Marconi during this whole ordeal is they're doing their gentlemen going back and forth in the news and calling each other names. Marconi claimed this was scientific hooliganism. And I love that term. I think we shouldn't even call it hacking anymore. We should just call it scientific hooliganism.
Hooliganism. I like
that's
it.
That's right.
You cyber hooligan.
That's right. We're all cyber hooligans, right? And that's okay.
Online miscreant.
That's right. We need the scientific hooliganism nowadays, right? And we, what is the Netflix thing? Chaos Monkey. We have very similar, terminologies nowadays that we kind of use for things that go out and actually test our new technology to see where the holes are at, where the security holes are at.
I don't want to interrupt you. Well, I guess I do. I'm not sure all of our listeners know what the Chaos Monkey is. If you want to.
No, go ahead.
Background. The Chaos Monkey is what Netflix uses, and it is a specific program that is set up within their network and on their systems to break things. So it's allowed to just pretty much wander their systems and break whatever it can. And the theory at Netflix is, well, if this thing breaks it, then we need to be able to know how to fix it because our users are probably going to do something, too, that will mess things up. And by having this constant monkey in our system that just goes around and breaks and jacks things up by actually trying to contain and respond to the monkey, it will make us better at security.
Right.
So, continue, Dustin.
No. Yeah. For those security professionals out there, think of it as like a very advanced fuzzer. it's almost like a fuzzer with a little bit of AI mixed into it, right? Which sounds terrifying to most people out there, but it's actually a very good thing, and Netflix uses it, and it has served them well so far. So going back to this somewhat dispute between Marconi and Maskelyne, Maskelyne was also kind of mad at Marconi because he was using this technology, and Marconi was being a bit of a I can't remember what we call him nowadays, but someone who goes and makes a bunch of patents and like applies for patents. A patent troll. That's right. How could I forget that terminology? He was kind of being a patent troll back in the day, and of course, you know, Maskelyne and the Telegraph people, they wanted to it was almost like the first defacement. It was almost like this was a defacement of a web page, but instead it was a defacement of a transmission that was happening. So we've come a long way. We've come from scientific hooliganism, and we still kind of have that now to bounty programs with specific entities out there, and paid for hacking, pen testers. Of course, security auditors are out there kind of doing this to a certain extent. Maybe not sending Morse code slurs over a open frequency, but something along those lines. And of course, then we've had this progression, right, from these very early days of saying, well, you know, knowing the frequency is actually a security. No, we know that's not true now, right? We have, again, solid state's taken over. Everybody has a radio. Everybody can, you know, build a radio pretty easily, or find a 12-year-old on YouTube showing a demonstration on how to build a radio, you know, to tune into a specific frequency. You know, all these these amazing kids online that like just understand this stuff way further than we ever did at that age. So we have this access to the technology and this access to that. So that's no longer a thing. It did make a progression, though, where I believe the first military encrypted radios were they would hop frequencies. Right. So then not only did you have to know the frequency, you had to know the span of the frequency, and you had to know the timing of the frequency. Well, now that's very easy to hack into now as well. Right. And of course, now we've gone into all kinds of different ciphers, and we have modulations, and we have a plethora of different mechanisms out there in order to protect our wireless transmissions. And that's happening in our households as well, and in our enterprises, right? We have You know, it happened with WEP, right? We had WEP with Wi-Fi. Then we had WPA, then WPA2. Now we have WPA3, which, you know, apparently they already found a flaw in. So they're trying to go back to the board on that one and figure out how to fix it. But it is this, it all kind of spans from this original hack that happened. And I love talking about it because I don't really think, yeah, we've definitely progressed, but we haven't gotten much further away from the core of this whole thing, which is, you know, we make a new technology and we say, here it is, you know, we business wise, we want to push it out to production as quickly as we possibly can. We've kind of gotten better as a community at saying, whoa, let's test this security, you know, not to be a naysayer, let's just test it to make sure it's secure first. And then we'll put it into production. We've gotten better at that, but not much. Right. And, you know, we're looking to the future on all these great new technologies that are coming out. And we're worried about, you know, somebody hacking into our blockchain. But what we really should be worried about is people hacking into our current networks, because they're not necessarily secure, right? We still have these kind of old, these old hacks that are still working, these old social engineering attacks that are still working. And speaking of social engineering, actually, Frank and I, we have a buddy who worked out on in the West Coast, and he was a pen tester. And I think I reached out to him one day. I was like, hey, man, how's it going? How's the new job? And he said, oh, it's awesome. We had a magician coming today. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, we had a magician coming today to teach us like sleight of hand to do social engineering attacks. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. I asked them if they were hiring, because I wanted to go and see a magician and learn from a magician on how to do sleight of hand. But, you know, again, this is another example of how things haven't really changed that much. We still are, you know, utilizing some of the same things that even this guy was using back in the 1800s.
Yeah, it's interesting that things, I mean, really haven't changed much. And even earlier on, you were talking about how the Trojan horse is, you know, now an attack method. So what are some valuable lessons that we should learn from the past that can help secure us? You know, the technology might be different, but the attack types are the same. So what can we do to just be a little bit more secure and learn from the past?
I think it's interesting because you have a couple different ways of thinking about this. Macrony would have saved himself a lot of embarrassment if he had just taken time to conduct, you know, any kind of assessment on what he had created, right? And I also, what's interesting was, I think one of his quotes was, I will not argue with anyone who does not fully believe or in my technology. And it's like, well, that's not the point. That's not the point at all. That's like saying, oh, I'm not going to talk to anyone who doesn't completely agree with everything I say. That's a horrible way to live, right? I think you're seeing now, though, businesses are doing secure DevOps, right? Or DevSecOps, however you want to pronounce it. Secure DevOps, DevSecOps. I don't care. I'm sure someone out there does care, and they're going to send me a tweet. But whatever you want to call it, it's not nearly thoroughly, how do I put this? It's not adopted nearly well enough in the industry. I mean, we've talked till we're blue in the face about how security seems to go out the window for functionality, at the altar of functionality, especially when you get to IoT stuff, right? It's like, well, it works. Now I can do this. It works. It's great. It works. So, you know, people throw it out there and call it a day. And I think that's also, though, part of the problem with new technologies, especially in the field of technology. New things are happening all the time, and not everyone really gets what's happening, right? So many people, for example, still don't know what their smartphone does or how it works. And it's that lack of understanding that kind of puts you in a really tough spot, because how are you supposed to handle something safe, right? So, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's almost the consistent answer of, you know, organizations need to do more DevSecOps and have good hygiene. They should also, organizations should know what their risk profile is and how cyber mature they are, depending on what their analysis is of their organization. And individuals need to continue to take those smart steps of staying aware of what's happening or what could be happening, taking the extra couple minutes to do some research before you buy something, right? Take a couple minutes to assess, you know, should I be doing X, Y, or Z? I sound like a broken record sometimes, but basic cyber hygiene can do so much to save you in the long run. What do you think, Dustin?
Yeah, no, and I feel like I'm going to be a broken record here because I've talked about this on numerous other episodes of our podcast. But you know, creating that culture of cybersecurity within your company, right? Creating that we're not trying to scare people or make people afraid, but we are trying to make, just like you said, Frank, make this level of awareness happen with our enterprises and with our users, with our end users. Those are the important people, right? They're the ones who need to use this technology on a daily basis. And they're also our first line of defense. They really are. I know that, you know, I'm probably going to have someone come and argue with me. Nope, your security operations center is your first line of defense for cyber attacks. Maybe. But I think if you create that initial, cultural building block, or a foundation for the building blocks of a secure environment, I think you're going to find that your main people, that even the ones that aren't technological, in a technological role, are going to be the ones who are your first line of defense, because they're going to be the ones who are going to make strong passwords that they'll remember. They're going to be the ones who are going to enable two-factor authentication. They're going to be the ones who are, being cognizant of what they're doing and how they're doing it, and just making sure that they're being mindful of their day-to-day actions within the digital environment. That's huge. And then another thing that kind of goes back to this, original hack is knowledge, right? Marconi had all these patents and he had all this knowledge, and he just thought he was the only one who knew how to do all that kind of stuff. And even him saying, well, I'm not even going to talk to anybody who doesn't understand, it's like, okay, well, I get it. And he had some, and Marconi, to his, jumping to his defense here, he had some naysayers at the beginning. He had some people that were like, wireless communication, that's snake oil. And this isn't really happening. This is a
hogwash.
Yeah. They thought it was a magic trick. They thought it was false. So I can understand him, kind of getting a little uppity when someone's like, this will never work. He's like, hey, look, I've been doing this for, however many years. Wireless communication works. I've sent messages over the Atlantic at this point. So I got off on a tangent there, but coming back into it, having the knowledge and having open source knowledge on this kind of stuff. And we are seeing that more and more today in the industries, in enterprises, turning more towards open source software, because you, at that point, you have free, maybe not free, but really cheap testing of code, SAST and DAST, right? You have really, people are actually into it, and they're actually looking at the code, and there's lots of people who are reviewing it and finding different holes and patching those holes. And so you do kind of see this now, where we're starting to share knowledge a little bit more. We're starting to share experiences. We're starting to share not only how cyber attacks can happen, but how they have happened to us and how we were able to stop it or not stop it, but how we can stop it in the future. And I think that's a big part of it. I think just the sharing of knowledge, that we've definitely evolved from since the late 1800s has really exponentially made our networks more secure and our people more aware.
Yeah, and on the note of culture and the shift in cybersecurity culture, how are organizations responding to, people like Mescaline who might try to get into a system and point out vulnerabilities? I know a lot of organizations have bug bounty programs, but are we really moving toward that quick enough? And is this something that organizations should consider doing?
I think we are. I think that we're moving, I don't know if we're moving quick enough. I never know if we're moving quick enough in cybersecurity. It seems like the cyber criminals are always, one step ahead of us. I think we're trying to get to a point where we're staying one step ahead of them. But right now we're in such a reactionary position or stance within our industry that it's hard to tell at this point. But I think we are getting better at it. I think that, the bug bounty thing is a good start. I think there could be more that we do. And I think that we can definitely start younger. I've seen some countries such as Israel are starting, K-12. Like, they're just starting that early with an idea of what cybersecurity is. And you want to talk about a culture of cybersecurity. That's, you start with kids in kindergarten. That's really getting into the culture of not only, of not only cybersecurity, but the culture of the actual people living in a specific area. So it's, we are doing a lot. We could always be doing more. And we could always be moving. I don't want to say moving faster, but we could always be moving more mindfully throughout this process of learning and creating more secure, more secure minded people. Frank, what do you think?
I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. I think I especially like the idea of whoever can crack that cybersecurity in kindergarten nut. That would be amazing. Right. I'm ready for that. I've got a 4-year-old at home and he loves, as he puts it, he loves mommy's iPad. Right. And I'm just trying to make sure he stays safe on it. And if you can make cyber real for him, that'd be great. I do think there is a bit more of a way to go for the overall acceptance of bug bounty hunters, because I still hear too often stories of people who find bugs, go to report it, and instead of being awarded what they are rightfully due, what they should be awarded, they're either not, or in certain instances, arrested. So that, I think, still has some evolution to undergo. However, I do think we're getting better, and I do look forward to it being more of a global adoption.
Thanks, Frank and Dustin. And that's all we have time for in this episode of the ISOCA podcast. But if you're interested in hearing more from Frank and Dustin, be sure to subscribe to the ISOCA podcast. And if you're a regular listener to our podcast, please check out our show notes, which contain a link to a brief survey in which you can share your feedback on how we can improve the ISOCA podcast.